Welcome to the Rand CRE Show. Commercial real estate with no stone left unturned.
What's up, everyone? This is Dylan Marma bringing to you the Rand CRE Show, joined by our co-host, Mike Taravella. How you doing today, Mike?
No, just living the dream, making it happen. And I'm excited to have our multifamily advisor who's helped me through the ranks and get to where I am today. So excited to have him on and provide a ton of value to our listeners.
Absolutely. Very excited for today's show. We have a great friend of ours on the show here. Before we get started, I always need to give a quick reminder. The Rand CRE Show is hosted by Rand Commercial Real Estate. We are a vertically integrated real estate investment and advisory firm, providing opportunities for investors to create passive streams through real estate investing, as well as providing active investors with the ability to source debt and equity across the board. So if you do have questions about how to fund your next deal, or if you'd like to partner with us through investing passively, you can always reach out to us at randcre.com. So Mike, why don't you go ahead and introduce us? Who do we have on the show today?
So today we have the honor and privilege of having John Kasman, host of Target Market Insights. He has one of the best real estate meetups in Chicago, has about 90 million in assets under management, and is just a great player in the space. So welcome to the show, John. How's everything going?
It's going great, guys. Dylan, Mike, thank you for having me on the Rand CRE podcast. Really excited to talk to you both today, and excited to just share more information and try to help other people kind of build their real estate portfolio in multifamily.
Absolutely. So what's, I guess, been latest with your business going into 2020?
Yeah. So, you know, 2020, like most people, you know, you kind of do an inventory of what your 2019 was. We took a look at what we did and went back and looked at our goals. And, you know, we kind of fell a little short, to be honest with you guys. We fell a little short of our goals. We were hoping to do more deals than we did. We did two larger deals, 172 unit and 138 unit. We had opportunities to do more, but we felt that it was better to be in a position of continuing to be patient and diligent and, you know, getting a bigger slice of the pie on some of the deals going forward, as opposed to just doing deals to do deals. So in doing that, one of the main things we did was, you know, recognizing the areas where we need to kind of course correct. And part of that is just being more aggressive with our deal flow, you know, seeing more deals, you know, trying to build even stronger broker relationships. And then, quite frankly, expanding our markets. You know, we've been really focused on a handful of markets, and there's only so many deals, especially the sizes that we're talking about.
Which markets?
I moved to Cincinnati over the summer. So I like Cincinnati in a 2-hour radius is kind of my core market. So Cincinnati, Dayton, Columbus, Northern Kentucky, down to Lexington, and up to, you know, Northwest, up to Indianapolis. So really, like, if I'm looking at, you know, larger markets, Cincinnati, Indianapolis, Columbus, Lexington are kind of the core, but we'll look at any kind of opportunity that has some scale in between that, that 2-hour radius. In addition to that, we also partner with other operators in growing Southeast regions markets, right? So we look at Jacksonville, Florida. We love the Carolinas. Texas is a market we're pretty heavily invested in right now. So we do like some of those Southeast region markets as well.
That's awesome. Well, I think we can relate a lot in terms of when you look at 2019 and the year in itself. I think going out, we wanted 4 to 6 deals, I think, was what we believe more in our capacity. Looking back at the year, we ended up with 2 deals throughout the year, right? 2 larger deals, very similar to that extent. And I guess when you look at that, there's a few things. There's the controllables, there's the things you can't control, right? And you can't really spend too much time dealing about the things you can't control. And I think it's easy to take the stance of, well, the market's where it is and there's no good deals out there. But I also think that's not quite the most empowering stance to take, right? And I think you've done similar to us, is really look from a higher level at what are we doing, right? What is our current strategy? How can we improve our strategy to still maintain a quality deals that we're presenting to our investors? We're not going to go out there and overpay for things. That's not a valid strategy. But how can we create a strategy that's going to be more in alignment with, to provide us with the, you know, an ample amount of deal flow to be able to provide to our investors, as well as to allow us to hit our goals with that, instead of shrinking our goals? How can we align our strategy more so with where the market is right now? So I guess that's something that I'm interested in hearing, and I'm sure our audience is very interested in hearing, is what kind of changes have you made to your strategy, and what were your major takeaways reflecting on 2019 and how to best handle the market that we're in?
That's a phenomenal question and great point, right? I think one, it's important to, and the word you used was empowering, right? And I think it's really important to recognize the power you still have in a situation. It's easy and quite frankly, lazy to just say the market's too hot. There's no good deals. I'm going to wait. And the reason I say that, and it's not even that it's lazy as much as it is, it really is... I'm going to use the word irresponsible, but the reason I'm saying that is to just stop, to just decide you're not going to look and you're just going to wait. What you're not doing is you're not factoring in the opportunity costs, right? If you wait 2 years to do a deal because you think the market is overheated, you now have to factor in what else were you investing in? Did you just leave your money in a savings account? Did you leave it in a stock market? Did you leave it in your retirement account? I mean, you have to have the money somewhere. So as an investor, you know, you have to look at everything in its totality, especially if you start thinking about the tax benefits, you know? So if we reverse engineer even why the market is hot in the first place, part of it's hot is because people are recognizing what a great investment multifamily actually is, not just from the income producing cash flow that comes from the property, but also the appreciation potential, the leverage that's available to the property, as well as the tax benefits, especially with, you know, the revised tax code. And now you have the ability to, you know, add bonus depreciation and take a pretty significant loss based on, you know, a cost segregation analysis. So when you factor all that in, that doesn't even start to talk about, you know, foreign investors who are looking to place their capital into, you know, a solid asset. That doesn't factor in 1031 exchange investors, those who are looking to get money out of other retirement accounts, those who are living on the coast who want to see better returns, those who are pessimistic on the stock market and just know at some point these, you know, artificial inflations can't go on forever. So there's so many reasons that multifamily is hot that you can't just ignore it. The other thing is, you know, I talk to a lot of people all the time, obviously. And, you know, for the folks who are sitting on the sidelines waiting, I would say, how do you assume that it's just going to go back to regular market levels? Are rents going to drop 10% over the next 5 years that I don't know about? Are housing prices going to drop? I mean, typically things inflate and they continue to go up over a long period of time. I don't expect to be able to buy my grandparents' house for $10,000 in 20 years. So over the long haul, I still think it makes sense to continue to invest and just be mindful of what the market value is. And obviously, when prices are depressed, that's a great opportunity to buy as much as you can. And when things are a bit inflated, you may want to be more selective on what you buy. I said all of that and I did not get to your question. So I'm so sorry, Dylan. All right. Let me answer your question more directly here. So what we're doing in our business, first and foremost, is we have to look at the deal flow. How many deals are we analyzing? Before we were, you know, we would look at deals. We had our broker relationships. We call brokers. Hey, what deals do you have? They send us the deals. We talk to our wholesalers. They send us the deals. We try to build some relationships with property owners and property managers, and we would go through it. What we didn't have was a system that had some benchmarks that we were crystal clear on how many deals we needed to see to get a good deal. Now, a lot of people will tell you need to see 100 deals to get 30 that are worth, you know, analyzing. 10 of them are worth putting in an offer to get one deal, right? That's kind of the loose rule of thumb.
Sure.
And I think if you just use that for right now, the reality is that I don't think we saw enough deals to even evaluate. The second part of seeing deals is you have to be a bit more creative in how you look at the deal, what the opportunity is for a value add. And we focus on a value add strategy. And for your listeners who may not know what value add is, that's where you're buying an asset that is already producing income from day one. You are looking at opportunities to increase the net operating income, either by increasing the income, adding amenities, maybe you start charging for pets or increasing the charge for pets, adding, you know, preferred pricing for different floor plans, different things like that to boost the amount of income you're making. Or you reduce expenses. Maybe you decide, you know, the money you're paying for a pool and the upkeep of the pool isn't worth it because, you know, that's money that's going out of the bottom line. Maybe you can implement a RUB strategy where you can either bill tenants for a portion of the utilities or get them to use less water. Maybe you replace the toilet. So there's different strategies there to reduce the expenses. So what's our business plan going to be? The other thing that you can look at is the structure of the deal if you have investors. So for us, you know, we kind of walked around with a pretty traditional model as far as what the split was for investors and for the operators. So we started looking at that to say, okay, well, do we really need that amount to make the deal work? You know, would investors be interested in taking a little bit less? Is there a way to structure the flow of the money, whether it's more cash flow up front, a little bit more on the back end for us? Is there different things there that we can pull on the levers where we still think it's a great deal and good cash flow, but it still allows our investors to be made whole, right, from the investment standpoint? So you just look at the levers you have to pull. And for us, it's deal flow, first and foremost. It's our creativity on the business plan. And then it's the structure of the deal. And within structure of the deal is also the financing, how you structure the debt, you know, how much is your cost of capital, and how are you looking at that? So I think those are the three main levers that you have to pull. So we've kind of looked at all three of them to say, okay, how can we be better to give ourselves a better option or more flexibility to do more deals that are still beneficial for us as well as our investors as we enter 2020?
Yeah, I think it's key at the beginning when you talked about being lazy and irresponsible, because it kind of segues into, if you just stop the machine, then your pipeline is broken. Your investors are going to go away. So then you're going all the way back to day one. Well, meanwhile, it's how can I get deals? How can I be creative? Thinking these tough questions to really build your business and continue to learn and grow. And that's when you realize maybe we need to restructure this way or have this value add, or it just allows you to free flow and think about the risk. And I think a lot of people talk about many different risks, but opportunity risk is one risk that gets neglected when going in these hot markets and trying to figure out these different strategies.
Totally agree. I'm actually in the middle of reading a book that I would recommend for a lot of the audience and anyone in any form of business. It's The Mind of the Strategist. And in the book, they talk about your strategic degrees of freedom. And one thing that you just hit on there were the various levers that you can pull. So you're in business, your product is creating a solid investment for the folks that you have in your investor list, right? And the question that you're asking yourself is, how can I continue right now with the current strategy? Maybe there's a lack of what we're doing, right? And what are the different levers you can pull, or the different degrees of freedom? There's, what is our deal flow? Where are we sourcing deals? What markets are we investing in? What kind of service are we providing? What is our cost of capital? What is our target return that we're offering to investors? I think the biggest thing, I think if you go out there and you offer a 10% return to your investors, and that's truly what you believe the deal is capable of, and that's truly what your team feels is maybe, you maybe think the deal might be able to overperform that a little bit, but you feel confident at that, and you have a lot of people that are getting on board with that in the first place, then that's great, right? But I think where the challenge is as operators, I think where people, as long as you're straying away from promising something that you don't believe you can hit, right? I think that's always the thing with operators, right? I think people are hesitant to offer less. I think the 15% mark right now is kind of the mark industry-wide that everyone's looking for. But that is one lever you can pull, is do I want to offer less returns and be just transparent on the front end about this is what we're offering? Because if you can find a cheaper cost of capital, you will do more deals. That is one way of doing it, right? If you're open to more markets, you will also do more deals. If you talk to more brokers, you'll do more deals. If you're open to different size deals, you'll do more. If you're open to heavy lift deals, you can do more, right? If you're open to bridge debt, that's going to open up new doors, right? So there's all these different levers that you can pull that will increase or decrease deal flow. And I'm not here saying anyone's right or wrong, but I'm just saying that, you know, as a sponsor, I think when you're evaluating your strategy, you really want to lay it all out and peel back layers and ask yourself, you know, what are the different levers we can pull? What are the different degrees of freedom, and how can, you know, I design a strategy that's going to be fit to win against the current market environment and against the competition that's around us, if you will.
Yeah, I think the word you hit on is integrity, right? Because ultimately you can make, I mean, they're numbers, right? And there's the quote that numbers don't lie, but they can be manipulated, right? And I think the reality is that there are many deals that you could look at and you can easily make the numbers deliver a 16% or 17% IRR return or whatever number you're trying to hit. I think the reality is, you know, you have to have integrity to be able to go through the assumptions that you're using as you're going down the document and doing your underwriting to make sure that you are protecting your investors first and foremost. So for us, that's a non-negotiable. You know, you have to be integrous. You have to protect the investors first and foremost. We have to weigh the amount of risk in a deal with the amount of reward and upside. Totally. And that's why we like value add in particular, because if we can buy something that is making money day one, and we can go in with a plan to improve the operations, not kick everybody out, not go down to vacant, not, you know, do a crazy heavy lift. We're putting $10, $15, $20,000 per unit into the renovation, but finding ways to, you know, upgrade a kitchen or to change a floor plan, or, you know, little things that make a big difference in boosting the NOI, and buying in the right locations too. If we can buy in areas that are seeing good growth, that puts us in a position to feel strong about not just the IRR. I mean, that's great. I honestly would tell an investor, you should never invest with us because of the IRR number that you see. And I would say any investment, whether it's us or anybody, you should never invest solely based on the IRR. Should invest based on the business plan and how strong you think the business plan is.
The risk adjusted return. Right.
Exactly. You want to make sure you're in a great location or a good location that's seeing progression. And then obviously, if it's a rougher location, you want an operator who has more experience and has demonstrated the ability to do those heavier turns and those more challenging turns. And as well, you may want, you know, those risk adjusted returns to be a little bit higher since there is more going on there.
Yeah. I just want to chime in on that, because I think, you know, we're in a very similar niche. We're looking after the value add investments. And I think we can look at this two ways, but I think if you look at where we are in today's market, it actually provides us with a really exciting opportunity in a lot of ways, because I think what's going to happen is that the market's going to correct itself. And a lot of the people that are in it right now are new sponsors that are getting into it and think it might be easy, or think the returns can be sky high based on what the market's done in the last few years. I think they will find their way out of the market, as right now it's going to require us to be especially savvy, right? You need to be tight with your systems. You need to really know your numbers. There's much less margin for error to walk away from a successful transaction, I believe, in the market that we're heading into. And especially right, we're still in an up market, but if things take a turn, it's going to get even more amplified. And I think what you'll find is that the sponsorship groups that have the best relationships with their management team, whether it's third party or in-house management, the sponsorship groups that really know their numbers, that really know what the improvement costs are when they're adding value to the unit, or know their markets and really know which submarkets and pockets of the town that they're buying in, going to be the ones that I think are going to survive in the long run, and also have probably the majority of capital flowing towards them, right? I think capital right now is still getting used to all these new sponsors and kind of figuring out what do they like, who's got good systems, who doesn't. Let's try working with this group. Let's invest with this group. But once they find tested and tried, sponsors after investing with several groups, they're going to say, we really like this one group. We feel more comfortable doing continuous investments with this group. And I think you're going to find the savvier groups that make it through successfully will walk away with a lot of the market share in place. I don't know if you guys have much touch on
that. I was going to say too, everyone gets excited when they get on a deal and are on, you know, I'm on this deal, and then it's day one of operations. That from then on, it's when the real work starts. It's not just getting the investors. And I think there's a lot of material out there to show how to get your first deal, but I don't think there's enough content out there of how to manage the deal, how to manage the managers. So making sure your operations, and like you said, John, with your systems and efficiencies, not only you're cutting expenses, you're looking at the resident experience, whether you're increasing amenities and having that up to the market, or reducing redundant expenses that don't inhibit the resident experience. I think it's just looking at those pieces. And I don't know if, you know, managing to that, you got to make sure that you're executing that business plan going forward.
Yeah, I mean, you guys hit it spot on, right? I think from an operator standpoint, you absolutely need to understand the market, the renovations, you know, what your business plan is. And Mike, to the point you were making there, you really have to understand your customer, right? I mean, we always talk about renters and tenants, and I try to actually avoid using either one of those terms, because they're the customers, right? These are the people who are end buyers. They're the person who is going to make a decision and let us know whether or not we over improve the unit, or whether or not, you know, we didn't do enough of the right upgrades, or what they like about the unit. So understanding that customer is really key to the experience. You know, it's happening to my marketing background. You know, I think the first place we should start is not necessarily with the property management. It's actually with that renter. What are they really looking for? You know, and understanding, you know, what they're looking for, where's the opportunity in the market? You know, why are people renting, where they're renting, and why. You know, those are kind of the things that I think you really have to uncover, and then build your business plan based upon what they're looking for. And obviously the property manager is a person who can help you understand what the person is looking for. But I wouldn't just rely on their word of mouth or their, you know, observations. I would look at either some first person research, some data, and I don't think it'd be wrong to sit and interview, you know, prospective customers and tenants and ask them, hey, you know, what would you be willing to pay for? Or you've lived in this neighborhood for a couple of years, or you applied here and ended up renting somewhere else. Why? You know, actually talking to these people would give you the insights you need of what's lacking at the property and what the, where the opportunities lie in building a better business plan.
Perfect timing. Just a week ago, when from the date when this show is going to hit, we had a podcast with our regional manager, Jen Outland, and we talked about net promoter score, right? And we talked about getting really close with the residents and learning what would they rate the score? How likely would they be to refer this to someone else? And what do they like and what don't they like? What's the reason behind their NPS? So definitely agree with that. And it's been something that we've been making a big focus. And I know you touched on your marketing background, and I want to maybe think about your podcast, right? You have a podcast that I know Gino and I have been on a few months back, Target Market Insights. And shifting to that, wanted to first learn about how has marketing and coming from the marketing background helped you in multifamily? And then two, why Target Market Insights? Why did you feel like that was the name for your podcast and the topic you really wanted to double down on?
Can I be very honest with you guys?
Please do.
You're in a safe okay. space.
All right. So when I made the decision to start working with other investors, you know, I started leaning on other syndicators and mentors and other folks and just, you know, consuming all the content that I could consume. And the challenge that I faced was I was living in Chicago at the time, and I had two markets, Chicago and Cincinnati, because I knew eventually I'd be moving to Cincinnati. And Chicago, for those who are not familiar with Chicago, there are a lot of 2 to 4 units in the city. You have more, you know, some 6 units, some 8 units, some 12 units, but not a whole lot of large apartment complexes. So as I learned about multifamily and the way people were valuing deals and underwriting deals and all that stuff, none of it worked in Chicago, not in my neighborhoods. So I actually struggled to take a lot of the lessons and information I was learning, all the rules, the 2% rule, none of that crap works in the neighborhoods we were in Chicago. Mm-hmm. So I had to figure out what in the world was, you know, would permeate across every market. You know, how could I take what's working for everyone I knew in Dallas, Texas? Because I know a lot of people were investing in Dallas, Texas, right? So how could I take what was working for them in Dallas, Texas and adjust it to make it work for me in Chicago? And as I was going through that process, part of the success that I had leading into this was I knew how to pick the right neighborhoods. I bought North Center back in 2012. I did that because I looked at a bunch of data. And the one thing that popped out to me was it was the only neighborhood out of 77 distinct Chicago neighborhoods that did not lose any value during the economic downturn. Now, I didn't know what that meant as far as, you know, trajectories or anything like that. But I knew if it didn't lose money in 2008, 9, and 10, that it was probably going to be okay for the foreseeable future for me. Right. There were no like gleaming star, shining arrows as far as this is the right neighborhood for me after that, right? So the next one I looked at was Logan Square. I couldn't afford Logan Square. The prices were crazy, but I went right adjacent to that, which was a neighborhood called Avondale. So I knew how to find the neighborhoods in Chicago, but as the prices went up and as I started to bring on investors and I need to actually give better returns, I had to go into neighborhoods that were not necessarily the neighborhoods that I would typically live in. So in going through that process, I really needed to understand, well, I'm looking at all this data and I don't know which ones are, which, what is the most important, right? How do I cipher through this? What are other people doing? So I launched Target Market Insights selfishly to learn how others were finding the best places to invest. And that's all I really wanted to do. So Target Market Insights was really about location, 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 identifying the best markets and submarkets for real estate investing. Now, I will tell you that after about 20 or 25 episodes, I answered my question. So the next challenge became, okay, now how do I grow in other aspects of real estate investing, in a particular multifamily syndication? And that's when I started to do, you know, more shows. And then ultimately, as time kind of went on, I expanded it from just being about market research and making it more about marketing holistically, branding, social media, attracting capital, you know, putting together packages, as well as market research and other materials like that as well.
Hold on. You said you answered your question after the first 25 shows. And that's what I think we're all eager to hear right now is, what was the answer to your question? 25 shows in, how do you identify the right target?
Yeah. So I asked every guest the same question, right? So I asked Joe Fairless, Brian Burke, Vinny Chopra, all of these other operators, and not just them, but property managers and brokers and all these other people. I asked them all the same set of questions. So as you start, you know, you ask 20 some people who are successful the same questions, you start to see trends pop up in all the answers, right? So I just started jotting down that, okay, well, pretty much everyone said this. Everyone said that. Most people said this. A few people said that. That was pretty interesting. So you start going through it all, and I just made a document. And I just started tracking it. So the short answer for your listeners, and get your pen ready if you're ready, or start taking notes. The first thing that everyone looks at is population. Now, one of the fallacies here, though, is everyone talks about population growth from an MSA level. I would argue that population at the MSA level is a little less relevant. What's more relevant is the submarket level. Let's take Chicago, okay? Since I keep picking on it. The Chicago MSA has been losing population for over a decade now, okay? If you really dive in, most of the loss is happening on the south side and the west side, and it's primarily coming from Black and brown neighborhoods. Now, that doesn't mean you should never invest in Chicago, because if you dive a little bit deeper, you will see submarkets where they're seeing really great growth and it's really consistent. So if I'm looking at a market, it's easy for someone to say, don't invest in Chicago. It's not a good MSA. But if you really know your stuff, you can dive in and say, you know what? These submarkets in Chicago are phenomenal. They're stable, they're strong, and they're a great place to invest. Let's take the reverse of that. There are markets that we know are phenomenal MSAs, Dallas, Orlando, Charlotte. There are pockets in those neighborhoods, in those cities, that are not seeing the kind of growth that the rest of the MSA is seeing, that are not great places to invest. So I wouldn't just look at the MSA level and say, okay, Charlotte, that's a great growing MSA, let's invest there. You really need to dive down into the submarket level. Now, obviously, if the MSA is doing great, you have a better chance of the submarket rising and doing great because there's just more people moving to it. But you have to understand it's a cheat sheet, right? That's a cheat sheet.
And the prices are going to reflect that. That's the other thing though, right? Because a lot of these out-of-state buyers, they're looking at the MSA. So number one, if the MSA is performing poorly, it's already going to scare people away. They're going to run away. And then the people that are more savvy, that do a little bit of extra homework like yourself, they're going to go in and find the pockets where they can still seize the opportunity and potentially seize it at a discount, right? Versus when you're paying for assets that are in a quality MSA, even this, you know, all ships rise with the tide, right? So if you're in the one pocket of the MSA that's doing very, very poorly, the prices won't reflect that. The prices on the asset are probably going to still be selling for a premium because the brokers are going to be pitching the MSA to a lot of people, right? So I just think it's something to always think about, because what really determines pricing, it's all perception. It's all, what do Mike and I, what do the other buyers think this property is going to be worth in X amount of time, right? Where is this market going, right? And so there's a lot of speculation, there's a lot of emotion and perception going into it. So the more granular you can get with actually knowing your market, I think you can really, that's really where you can find pricing arbitrage and win.
And brokers too are smart enough to know that, because you'll see emails of Nashville MSA, but then when you take the deep dive, you're like, wait, it's the city's not Nashville, it's neighboring. So it's
2 hours away.
Yeah, it's 2 hours away. So like you said, John, just really honing in on where the property is and where you're looking can actually make a fact, because like Dylan said, if it's a bad MSA, people aren't going to look at that deal, but it could be a phenomenal opportunity based on the submarket growing.
Yeah, and I think the key thing there is, and you mentioned the word speculation, right? The key part for me is I don't want to do a whole lot of speculation. Now, we don't know what's happening in the future, but you can dive pretty deep and find out what's happening, what are the current plans, what is the appeal, what are the attractions. So this goes deeper into the submarket level, and this is why I think it's really important to understand. I'm a little less concerned with the general numbers. I'm more concerned with what's happening and what's driving it, and what is demand, what's the reputation of the neighborhood, what infrastructure is in place currently, what infrastructure plans are in place, what developments are taking place, who's behind the neighborhood. So where is it headed, and is it really a neighborhood that's going to see growth, or is this truly just speculation? You know, without solid plans and without, you know, real demand and real amenities, you know, it's just hype. You know, it's just hype. I'll keep going back to Chicago. You know, there are a lot of folks who love South Shore, and South Shore now is starting to see some plans that I think will develop and make it an interesting investment opportunity. I would go a little further north because you have anchors. So this is something that, going back to your question here, I like to look for the path of progress. And when you look at a submarket, what you want to do is you want to identify the path to progress. Ideally, you get in front of that path of progress, right? And you're there ready. You can get just ahead of them, and you're ready when the people are coming. So you can buy it cheaper, and then they continue to move towards you. And now you're able to take advantage of that. That's what I did with the Avondale purchase. You know, I bought that because I was priced out of Logan Square. And guess what? Renters were doing the same thing. They were like, oh, I love Logan Square, but ooh, rents are $1,500. Oh, they're only $1,100 over here. I'm going to go pay over here. Well, guess what? You go buy over there, and then the people, it has the same amenities. It's just as close to the Blue Line as Logan Square is. It has very similar amenities, and restaurants are coming there. There's new developments, new restaurants coming, and new grocery store being built. So if you're paying attention to what's happening in these communities, now you can invest in them and kind of wait a couple of years and let the rest of the market catch up. And now you've built some, you know, some forced appreciation by doing those kind of things as well. So, I mean, those are some of the things that we like to look for, is what's happening in the area. We don't want to be the first person by any means. And then we also don't want to speculate and hope an area is getting better. I want to see that progression. You should be able to see the rent growth. You know, you should be able to see the rent growth in the market at a minimum, even if it's not an overall market rent growth or submarket rent growth. You should be able to take a look at a property that's been renovated and upgraded and look at what it's charging for rent and what it's able to pull versus a non-renovated unit and justify your business plan. So we're looking for all those kind of things to find the best places to invest.
Yeah, I think it was, you can't quote me on this, but I think it was a Howard Marks thing that I was looking at where he says, when you're investing in some kind of any asset that was distressed at any point, you want to start to see it come back to life first and at least come back at least 10% or so before you start to deploy capital that way. And it's, I think it's the same thing with the market, right? If you're looking at parts of town that used to have a bad stigma to it, you don't want to be the pioneer to say, let's put some money here because I believe this is going to work, right? You want to see some signals, even though you're going to miss out on that first 10% of uptick, it's worth it because, like we've talked about, your risk adjusted return is going to be a lot better if you're already catching on when there's a little bit of momentum on the train.
And I think too, one of my favorite lessons from you, John, was understanding the story behind the market. So I think everyone's data driven of if this population growth and this rent increase, based on this crazy formula of this is a market, but understanding the story behind it, the anchors, what's going on. The path of progress is a term you know a lot of people use, but they don't really understand of what anchors are coming to that market, and the numbers will follow. So just making sure you understand what's happening at that market and where it's going and why, really understanding the why.
And call me crazy, but one thing that we look at now is Reddit. Right. Reddit provides a lot of valuable insight, right? Because Reddit is where everybody out there is anonymously posting their thoughts on the market, or, hey, should I move to this part of town? Hey, I'm moving into the city. Which parts of town should I live in? And just like you said, kind of cross-referencing what a lot of people are saying all at once is going to give you some valuable insight, at least to my take.
Yeah. And go back to our lever conversation, right? This may be one of those places where if you have five or six levers, and you're being very, you know, conservative on them, and you have one or two where you want to be a bit more optimistic, but you know that, hey, the market can help you. All the data is showing you that these things can play. You know, you have to play with those levers. And I think that the market is a part of that. And to your point, you want to check Reddit. You want to check Bigger Pockets. I mean, any new market that you're looking at, one of the first things I would do is I would go on Bigger Pockets and I would just search best places to live and whatever. And you can do that in a city, right? So getting back to some of your other tips, super simple tip, best place to live in Chicago, Kentucky, you know, Charlotte, whatever city. And it's not that you go and try to invest in that submarket. Look around it. Look within a 5-mile radius and find the other neighborhoods that have similar qualities that maybe are a little bit more affordable. But, and again, if it's close to downtown, find another neighborhood that's close to downtown. If it's close to a major university, a major employer, a major highway, look for the same kind of amenities in the neighboring neighborhoods and then watch and see what's happening. Talk to the locals and figure out, okay, hey, this neighborhood didn't used to be that great, but then about 3 or 5 years ago, people started investing. Okay, now you know, okay, this neighborhood was great. Then this neighborhood started to improve. Now we've got a trajectory here. And if you can go here, that's great. Now, when I talk about anchors, and it's not a mistake, sometimes this is just how it is. Ideally, if you're going this way, I would love to see another anchor over here, a university, a highway, something over here so that they could converge on the neighborhood that I want to invest in. That's why I love Bronzeville in a neighborhood in Chicago, just to continue with this example, because you have downtown, you have the Loop, which is seeing crazy great growth, lots of development, lots of new jobs, lots of white collar employees coming there. You have the University of Chicago to the south of it. So, which is always going to have young students, which equals a new pool of potential renters who, guess what, love downtown, who are always getting on the train going north through it. So you have these two anchors. So investing in between those two anchors, that's going to give you the best chance at potential growth. Now you can look at it and you can see, you know, what's happening as far as rent and all the other things, but some of this doesn't have to be data driven. I love data, but some of this is common sense and using the eyeball test and then using the data to qualify and verify it. But if you're investing in an area that, you know, is between two anchors that are seeing great growth and will continue to feed you renters, that's probably a really good chance for you to be successful implementing your business plan.
Yeah. And data is not always perfect, and it can be very difficult to find when you start to get more granular like this. I think that's what we find very often, right? When you're looking at apartments, sometimes you're seeing A-class apartments merged in with B and C-class data. When you're looking at population trends, typically on an MSA level, you can find some pretty quality data sources, but when you start to get more granular into the submarkets, it can be a little bit tougher, right? Depending on where you're looking, it can be definitely tougher to find exactly what everyone's doing. So you have to do your best with what's out there. So on that topic, we get asked a lot for what tools are you guys using to pull your data from. So we'd love to hear from you. What are some of your favorite tools or tools that you'd recommend the audience use when it comes to researching a market?
Yeah. So, I mean, MSA level, you know, we like to look at a lot of the same data. I'm sure you guys look at around this time of the year, Marcus and Millichap puts out an annual multifamily report. So I have not seen that yet, but I'll definitely keep my eyes open for when that comes out. And that really gives a high level overview of what's happening, what they expect to take place over the next 12 months. There is I'm trying to think of the name, IRR does a report as well annually that we like to keep our eyes on. And then there's another one that is slipping my mind. Milliken report. The Milliken report is another one that does a pretty good job. That one's a little less multifamily specific, but it still gives more of a population trends and what's happening. So those are three.
Yeah, Berkadia just came out for 2020 as well.
Yeah, so Berkadia as well. So there are a lot of national ones that I like to look at to help me with the MSA level. The submarket, like you said, it's pretty tough. One of the best things that you can do is if you have access to brokers, if you can get on their broker list, some of them will send out kind of a quarterly report of what's happening in the market. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the best things that you can do is really get on their list, see the report. I think Cushman Wakefield does one. I know Capstone, which is, I think, more in the Southeast region and more kind of Midwest, Kentucky, Ohio, Tennessee region. They do one. And there are a few others that do that. So if you can find groups or brokers that distribute that, that's another great way to stay on top of it. Honestly, some of the things we do are a bit more bullish. I mean, we get down and dirty. I sign up for Google Alerts on neighborhoods that I'm interested in. You can look at a couple different maps, especially maps that will lay out household income. So, and I have a whole list of this, by the way. City-data.com is another website we like to use. And I can send you guys a list of all the resources that we recommend. DataUSA.io is my secret. You know, I use that, and I normally don't tell people in public about it, but you guys are friends, so I will tell you that. The reason I love that website is it does a really good job aggregating a lot of the data that we normally spend a whole bunch of time trying to find. So it will pull in the U.S. Census data. And by the way, it's visual. It's beautiful. Most of the places we're talking about look like shit. And I hope I can swear, or excuse me. But they look terrible. You know, they're not visually appealing. It's an accountant ready. Yeah, yeah. No one designed it. It's just like, it's not a great UX experience for anybody who's looking at it. But DataUSA.io, it's very visually appealing. They pull in the pertinent data. They break it down by household income, you know, ethnicity, gender, occupation, you know, how many people are driving to work versus, you know, taking public transportation. So you can get a real good sense of a market by digging into that data there. They also have some elements where you can start getting into household income. So if you know that you want to do, let's call it B-class apartments, and maybe for you that cutoff is $60,000, just making this up. Let's say, hey, I want to invest in areas where the average household income is $60,000. You can now go in there, and it's kind of color-coded, where you can now put pins in different neighborhoods, zip codes, and say, okay, hey, here are the ones that fit that. Now I have a sense of where to go and where to focus my energy going forward, right? So it just gives you a little bit of an opportunity, and it won't take more than 15 minutes, really, to dig down and start to get a sense of where the opportunities are in a market like that.
Yeah, I love that. I think all great resources, all things that we have in our arsenal of data tools. And I think those are all great shares. And I'd recommend, I know, John, you're well familiar with this. I'm sure you do the same thing. But to anyone listening, you know, as you're actually laying eyes on a property specifically, make sure you're checking out the CoStar and the Yardi reports. CoStar and Yardi are expensive. Most people are not going to budget them, especially if they're just launching their business. However, most large brokerages that you will be working with have access to these. So you want to make friends with the brokers. And as you're working with brokers, don't be scared to ask for a CoStar or Yardi report, because that's going to give you some very granular insight on the submarket and the comparable properties, and get in the weeds with some of the data before you actually are going out there and putting in offers.
Yeah, and I think the last part is the thing I would emphasize. Ask for that before you put in an offer.
Once
you put in an offer, or especially if you're under contract, now they're going to be scared to give it to you if there's something that they think is going to hurt them closing a sale. So make that a part of your process early on. The other thing is, if you run into any issues with a broker on that, if you're dealing with a larger property management company, a lot of times they have access to that data as well. Real Pages is a similar platform. I think they pull from, I can't remember which one, but they pull from one of those platforms too. But the point is, get someone else's data that will help you understand the market. At a minimum, there are other services like TurboTenant and other platforms that can help you pull rental comps. I mean, I've used RentPads before, and Rent Jungle and other stuff like that. So, I mean, ultimately, inform yourself. There, obviously, you can get up to the point where you're using the right tools and the industry recognized tools. But if you're not at that point and you're doing a six unit, by all means, do pull whatever you can pull. Go to Rent Jungle, go to Rent Zillow, go to whatever, and get the most information that you can that's available to you.
Love it. Now, you have an upcoming event, so I want to give you a moment to share with the audience a little bit about the upcoming event and how they can find out more information.
Yeah, we've got the Midwest Real Estate Networking Summit coming up May 16th and 17th. Now, this is an event that is all about investors. It truly is a networking event. There's no sales pitches. There's no BS. And no one's allowed to skirt around answers. You know, I don't know if you guys have been like me, right? But, you know, starting out, you would go to events, you get excited, and, you know, someone to tell you, hey, we're going to teach you how to buy multifamily. You're like, yeah. And you're sitting there and you're taking notes, and you haven't really learned anything that you can implement and use and is actionable for you, right? And it's just a whole lot of rah-rah. And that's not this, right? This is really about networking. There's education for sure. We certainly have great speakers that are lined up and coming to share information with us. But this is really about networking. And the reason it's about networking, as you guys can attest, the best way to build your business, especially as a multifamily investor, is by building a strong, powerful network. Whether you're looking for deals, whether you're looking for property management, whether you're looking for people on your team, underwriting assistance, help raising capital, whatever the case may be, it's all about the network. So for us, it's about bringing people together who are serious about elevating their business to the next level and giving them the resources, the relationships to move forward. One of the reasons this is really important for me is I actually did my first large apartment deal after going to a real estate event. I went to the Best Ever Conference in Denver with Joe Fairless, and I met my partners at that event. So I recognize the power that an event, a conference in particular, has to connect you with the people who are serious about elevating it, even more than a meetup, right? And I host a meetup, and I believe it's a great meetup. But nonetheless, you know, it's a little bit different when it's a low dollar or free event versus, you know, there's a cost, and you know these people are sacrificing a couple of days of their time to come out and
flying
connect.
In.
They're flying in. They're serious about building the network. They're going to be open to sharing, to connecting, to helping. And if you're someone who's saying, well, shit, I could do deals, but I need $1 million. You come to an event like this, you can find people who can provide you that $1 million. So it's really an imperative thing to open up your mind, you know, think about prosperity and abundance. And, you know, you mentioned this earlier, Dylan, but ask yourself, how can I, you know, how can I do more deals? Well, if one of the ways you can do more deals, if it relates to people, you know, either people to help you find more deals or people to help you raise money or bring money for deals or people to help you execute and manage these deals. These are the kind of events you want to attend. So May 16th and 17th, you can go to MidwestReSummit.com for more information. We're starting to get all of our speakers confirmed. So I'm super excited. I want to share some right now with you, but we'll have a list as all final confirmations are made. We're putting a list up on the website. We actually wanted Gino to come speak, but Gino's going to be on vacation this year. So we won't have Gino, but really excited for this event. This is our third event. So really excited to do the third annual Midwest Real Estate Networking Summit.
I would say I was an attendee of the first one, and I wouldn't be in multifamily. I didn't even know. I kind of had an idea of what it was, but it literally, I wouldn't be here today in the position I am if it weren't for John and the Midwest Real Estate Summit. So it's a great event, and you know, would highly recommend to our audience. And John, I want to ask you the investor pro tip. What is the, you know, with your background being in marketing and working with great brands and being in multifamily, what is the best marketing advice you would have for a new sponsor trying to get out to new investors?
Yeah, that's a great question. The first thing I would say is, you know, unlike most things in business, you have to be careful and understand the legalities of what's allowed and what's not allowed. You know, in most business industries, you know, you just start marketing, right? You can go on social media, you can showcase your product and drive awareness and get sales that way. With real estate syndication in particular, the SEC has some very strict and very direct guidelines of what you can and cannot do. So you do not want to go out there and blast your deal. You don't want to post it on social media. You don't want to advertise it unless you're filing a 506C offering. So the first thing is just understand the guidelines. If you're not familiar, you can just Google SEC Regulation D or SEC 506B, 506C, and start to get a sense of what you can and can't do there. Once you have a general sense of what's allowed and what's not allowed, I think the next thing that you need to focus on is building your brand. I think it's imperative for every operator to build a brand, because that is really the only thing that separates you from the next operator. All of us are selling the same thing, right? We're selling passive investment opportunities. Now, your numbers may be different from my numbers, which may be different from some other operator's numbers. It may be a different market. But at the end of the day, we're all selling passive investment opportunities. So what's going to stand out? It's going to be the people behind it. It's going to be the brand and the company that they see, that the comfort that they feel in knowing who they're partnering with. So building up that brand, I think, is critical to attract capital. And I say attract capital, not raise capital. The difference is, one, you're out there calling, pushing, doing a sales, right? You're doing a sales job. You're going through a list of people and you're calling all of them and you're trying to see if you can get the money you need to get. When you attract capital, people already have gotten to know you. They've already taken the time to learn more about you. That's why we do these podcasts, right? It's free information is great, but part of what it is I want people to get to know me through this means on their own time. So it's not that they have to hop on a call and get scared that I'm going to try to pin them down and, you know, get them to commit. How much are you looking to invest? No, we don't do that. Get to know me on your own time. Check out the podcast. If you like what you hear, if you think you'd like to invest with us, then at that point you can reach out and set up some time for us to talk. And I think you guys have done an excellent job with that. Jake and Gino and Rand Partners, you guys do an excellent job of giving information, educating people, and letting them get comfortable with you. So I would say if you follow that model, it's the best way to do it. Now, with that said, don't just be a copycat. I see way too many people looking at, you know, what you guys are doing and what other operators are doing and just saying, oh, I'm gonna launch one too. It's not really how this works. There's a lot of steps that go into it. And if you really want to build a brand, part of what you have to do is you have to find a way to stand out. And you can't stand out by doing the same thing everyone else is doing. So you really need to think about that and think about it from a branding standpoint, because a lot of operators are now podcast hosts. So that's not going to help you stand out. I mean, it will. It's good. But now you're competing with every other podcast host too, right? So you have to really think about the brand. And the brand is not what you create. It's what others see. So if we talk about, you know, soda, most people think about Coca-Cola first and foremost. You know, soda, I'm from Cleveland, so let's say pop, right? But if you think about, So if you think about it, you know, most people go to Coca-Cola first and foremost. That's the brand. You know, sure, there's the Pepsi's there and Faygo and so many others, but the brand is what comes to mind first, and you know, the image that you have. So, I mean, that's part of it, right? Is what do you want people to think about you? And how do you reinforce that? You know, I actually don't even think about ourselves as multifamily syndicators anymore. You know, for us, we really are in a position where we are people who help families create and preserve wealth. Today, multifamily syndication is the vehicle that we do that through. But at some point, we may offer up a completely different offering.
Right.
You know, and that's where, again, for us, that when, the way we focus on that is through the investor relations. You know, it's through understanding what people need. And a lot of our investors, yes, they would love to invest in our deals, but they're not investing in our deals because they love owning real estate. They're investing in the deals because they want passive income. They want the tax benefits, you know, and they want some upside potential. So that's what they're really focused. They don't care about the bricks. They don't. Most of them do not care. They want to know, hey, John, is this going to lower my taxes by $50,000 or not? And if so, they're interested. So you have to, I think, keep an open mind of what you're actually solving and then solve it. Because part of that problem is not, let me get your real estate deal, is let me help you with some overall tax saving solutions. Let me get you in touch with my CPA. Maybe you should talk to this asset protection guy that I know. It's really understanding how do you help that individual holistically versus just shoving your offering down their throat.
Yeah. Love that. Yeah. I always give that same similar advice in terms of it's not a sales job, right? If you've been in sales, take your sales hat off, because when you're working with investors, this is relationship building. I really like the emphasis you have on attracting capital versus raising capital, right? Because you never want to be the one that's desperate for the capital. If you are, you should, yeah, you probably have to do what you have to do in that instance, but you should, you know, if you have a good deal and you trust in what you're selling, then you might have to get out there and do that. But you want to create a strategy. This all, I think a lot of our episode, our message is on strategy, right? You want to create a strategy up front that is going to attract capital, that investors are going to agree with, that is going to put you in a position where when you do have something to offer, you have investors that are coming to you. Maybe if you're new, you also have a larger partner veers that also helps with bringing capital and partnering on the deal in some ways, right? And that all again has to be attracted to you. They're not just going to work with anybody. They're going to want to. You're going to have to build that relationship. So I think it's a powerful message for our listeners. And I think if I take away anything from this, I think even if you're just getting going, it's getting clear on your strategy before you get going, because your strategy determines what your brand is. It determines what your marketing message is. It determines how you're going to operate in the future and who's going to be there on the journey with you. So great tip, John, and want to hear from you. What's the best way that listeners can get in touch with you?
Yeah, so I'm on most social media platforms, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I spend most of my time on LinkedIn or Instagram. So those are probably the two best ones from a social media standpoint. But you can also, and I'm at jcasman is the hashtag, the handle. And then Target Market Insights is the podcast. You can check me out there. And you can always email me too, john@casmancapital.com. Would be happy to talk to you and answer questions, or, you know, hop on a call, a short call, if it makes sense to do that as well. But would love to talk to anybody who's interested in talking more. And Mike, we got to catch up again soon, man. I hope get out there and get together. And Dylan, love to get out there to where you guys are, and hopefully we can find some deals, man. Do some deals.
100%, man. Right? Yeah. Forward to it.
Kick off 2020 the right way.
That's right.
But thank you, John, for being on the show. And there you have it, folks, another edition of the RAN CRE Show. We appreciate everyone joining us. And if you have any question or things you'd like to see more of on the podcast, shoot us at info@rancre.com. Make sure you leave a rating, review, and comment wherever you listen to your podcast so we can help provide more value today. And until then, we will see you next week.
All right. Thanks so much, John.